From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Hope you had a great weekend, everybody. We are indeed the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. It's Monday, September 24th. That'll wake you up on a Monday morning. Hillary Clinton made the talk show circuit yesterday.
And apparently her interview on Fox News was a laugh riot. Did you see it?
I did. It's already up on YouTube.
It's pretty spectacular. We'll walk you through her walk through the talk show circuit yesterday.
Also, did you know that there's actually a slaughterhouse in the U.S. where they take horses and kill them?
Ew.
There's actually one of them left, although it looks like it's going to be shut down. A judge made a ruling on Friday. We'll tell you more about that.
Also, big doings in New York City today. President Bush is in Manhattan at the United Nations General Assembly. Gets underway. There's a whole lot on his plate, including, you know, the peace process in the Middle East. He's going to meet with President Abbas. Prime Minister Abbas. Sorry.
Prime Minister. And,
you.
You know, Marcel Marceau died over the weekend. He, a famous mime.
Mm-hmm.
But there was another guy who died on Friday who probably didn't get nearly as much coverage. His name was Walt Crowley, but he was a fellow that I kind of knew from Seattle. I did an interview with him a little while ago, and we're going to play part of that. It's an interview he did the day before he had surgery to remove his voice box. It was literally the last words he was speaking, so we'll hear some of that.
And also, we'll talk sports with my favorite sport. Bill Wolf, gonna get up a little bit early because he wants us all to root for the Green Bay Packers, and he'll explain why. We'll get today's top stories from our newscaster Rachel Morton in just a minute, but first, here's the BPP's big story.
Senator Clinton is our headliner this morning.
Senator Hillary Clinton of New York.
With a Democratic frontrunner.
Senator Clinton, thanks very much for joining us.
Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Apparently, when Senator Hillary Clinton decides to talk, she does it in a big way. The Democratic presidential candidate made the rounds of all five Sunday morning talk shows yesterday. Aside from the logistical feat of negotiating with all those bookers, it was Clinton's chance to grab more of the spotlight at the end of the week. Of course, this is the big week when she unveiled her new health care plan. The Washington Post summed up the appearances with the headline, quote, "Hitting all the Sunday talk shows, Clinton says a lot, but reveals little."
Now, in case you didn't watch them all back to back, let's boil it all down right now. The two major topics of conversation, the Iraq War and candidate Clinton's health care plan. On NBC's Meet the Press, Tim Russert asked Senator Clinton about her changing views on the war.
A new brochure that you've passed out to the voters in New Hampshire says this: Hillary will begin immediate phase withdrawal with a definite timetable to bring our troops home. When you were last on Meet the Press, I asked you specifically about a definite timetable. And this is what you said: "I think that would be a mistake. We don't want to send a signal to the insurgents, to the terrorists, that we're going to be out of here at some, you know, date certain. I think that would be like a green light to go ahead and just bide your time." You've changed your mind.
Well, the circumstances on the ground have certainly compelled me to continue to evaluate what is in the best interest of our country and our troops.
Over on CBS's Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer asked whether a withdrawal from Iraq would embolden our enemies, as President Bush has said.
Well, I think we have emboldened our enemies by the Bush policies. The big winner in the last 6 years has been Iran. There's no dispute about that. We have really emboldened them, as we have seen, and now we face a very difficult set of decisions to try to prevent them from obtaining nuclear capacity.
Now, the controversy over ads run by the liberal group MoveOn.org, that whole thing was so big last week, it also got play over the weekend. Here's a refresher for you. The ads referred to General David Petraeus, the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, as General Betrayus for his testimony given to Congress, which some felt was towing the White House line. On CNN's late edition, Wolf Blitzer played a clip of President Bush calling the ads a, quote, "sorry deal," and Senator Clinton said this in response.
Well, I thought it was pretty sorry when his campaign attacked Senator Kerry's record of service, and I thought it was pretty sorry when the Republicans attacked Senator Cleland. I don't condone attacks by anyone on the patriotism and service of our military. I am an admirer of General Petraeus, as I have said on numerous occasions.
Speaking of MoveOn, what a segue. We'll move on to the topic of Senator Clinton's health care plan. George Stephanopoulos, host of ABC's This Week, asked Senator Clinton whether her failed health care plan of 1993 would hurt her new proposal and whether we'd be better off with a president who, quote, doesn't bear the scars of that experience.
Well, I think the country bears the scars. You know, since we weren't successful, we've seen millions of more people without insurance and many millions more who have insurance except when they really need it and the insurance company tells their doctor or the hospital they won't pay for the needed treatment. And I think that what is so uniquely American about the American experience is that, you know, you get knocked down, you get back up. I've learned a lot, and I think I now know better how to do what there is a consensus building that we must do.
Some serious topics, certainly, but there were some laughs, maybe unintentionally. Here's Clinton's interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday. This is how it started off.
Senator, in an interesting bit of karma, we are talking on the first anniversary of my interview with your husband, and I would like to show you a clip from that interview. Here it is.
You did Fox's bidding on this show. You did your nice little conservative hit job on me.
Senator, talk about conservative hit jobs, right-wing conspiracies. Why do you and the president have such a hyper-partisan view of politics?
Well, Chris, if you had walked even a day in our shoes over the last 15 years, I'm sure you'd understand.
And then at the end, Chris Wallace says to her, so give the president my best. And basically that laugh happened again.
Oh, my gosh. Well, there you have it. Hillary Clinton's five appearances on the Sunday talk shows. The questions, the answers, the laughter. All wrapped up with a nice big bow on it, courtesy of the BPP. That is the BPP big story for this morning. Now let's check in with Rachel Martin with the rest of the news. Hi, Rachel.
This is NPR.
Hi, Luke and Allison. Good morning, everyone. World leaders have descended on New York City today for the opening of the United Nations General Assembly. Among them is Iran's leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The Iranian president is scheduled to attend the UN meetings this week, and today he'll appear at a talk at Columbia University. Students yesterday protested Ahmadinejad's invitation to speak at the school. Ari Gardner is a student at Columbia.
All of these rights that we enjoy, that we've been raised in America to appreciate, this man stands against. And as he's speaking to us, then students in Iran are being jailed.
Along with concerns about human rights and civil liberties, protesters condemn the Iranian leader's repeated denial of the Holocaust and Iran's alleged nuclear program. Relations between Washington and Tehran keep getting more intense over U.S. accusations that Iran is secretly trying to develop nuclear weapons. Ahmadinejad has denied this, and in an interview with CBS's 60 Minutes, he said Iran had no use for a nuclear bomb and that it's wrong to think the U.S. and Iran are heading toward any kind of military conflict. And today on the agenda of the UN meeting, global warming. World leaders will hear from California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger about how the U.S. is joining the effort. More than 150 countries will participate in today's talks on the environment. Al Gore will be there, so will German Chancellor Angela Merkel and France's President Nicolas Sarkozy. Not President Bush, though. Aides to the president say he'll skip the meeting, and instead he'll hold his own talks on global warming later this week. That meeting will focus on how to let countries set their own climate policies instead of relying on international treaties. The United Auto Workers Union is raising the stakes in its negotiations with General Motors. The union says if its demands aren't met by late this morning, its 73,000 factory workers will walk off the job. In a statement posted on the union's website, the UAW said they set the strike deadline because they say General Motors has failed to address job security and what the union has called other mandatory bargaining issues. And Luke and Allison just reminded you about that big ad, the MoveOn.org ad in the New York Times a couple weeks ago that called General David Petraeus, General Betray Us. Well, the New York Times' own public editor now says publishing that was maybe a bad idea. The ad sparked major controversy. Lawmakers from both parties condemned it and the New York Times for running it at a discount rate. A spokeswoman for the paper has apologized for giving MoveOn a break on the price for the ad. And yesterday, the paper's public editor, Clark Hoyt, wrote that the ad violated the Times' own written standard. But while taking his paper to task, Hoyt went on to say there was no evidence that the Times ran the ad for any partisan reasons. I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online at npr.org. Allison and Luke, back to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Lots of diplomatic goings on at the United Nations General Assembly as it gets underway in New York today. The controversy surrounding the U.S. visit by Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is overshadowing a key meeting with another Mahmoud as President Bush prepares to talk with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. The aim, the goal, the hope is to reinvigorate the peace process by maybe, just maybe, getting Palestinians and Israelis to agree to meet in November for a summit. You know, a situation is complicated when you have to have meetings to decide to have a meeting to meet. Daniel Kurtzer was President Bush's ambassador to Israel from 2001 to 2005 and President Clinton's ambassador to Egypt from 97 to 01. He is now chair in Middle East Policy Studies at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Mr. Kurtzer, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Let me get a little background of what's been going on the past few months. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has made 6 trips to the Middle East so far this year. Now, what was the purpose of those meetings, and how will her work be reflected in what happens between Mr. Bush and Mr. Abbas?
Well, until this summer, the secretary was looking for some angle toward which to move. And she had made clear earlier in the year that she was hoping that perhaps the two sides could arrange discussions on what she called an horizon. In other words, what's the peace process supposed to aim at? Where is it supposed to head? This summer, in mid-July, the president articulated this idea of having an international meeting. And since then, this has been an event which is supposed to galvanize support from the region and here. The problem until today has been there's been very little diplomatic activity to arrange this meeting. And you're right to say that only in the Middle East does it take an effort to arrange a meeting to have a meeting. But the good news today is the president is finally engaged to try to bring about the meeting that he called for in mid-July.
What will likely be on the top of the agenda for President Bush, and what will be on the top of the agenda for Mr. Abbas?
Well, it's very interesting you pose the question that way. The president is looking to bring together the parties so as to promote the ideas that he believes are necessary as a prerequisite for Palestinian statehood, namely that the Palestinians renounce terrorism once and for all and start the hard process of institution building for statehood. The Palestinians are going to come to this meeting. Mahmoud Abbas will come to this meeting arguing that the time has come for the United States to broker negotiations on the 3 key final status issues, namely Jerusalem, the fate of the Palestinian refugees, and territory. In other words, what to do about Israeli settlements and final borders. And the meeting really will be dictated by these 2 different agendas. And the question is going to be whether or not they can reach some meeting of the minds that would allow all these issues to be discussed at the international meeting in November.
All right. I hope I don't sound like a terrible cynic, but what makes today's meeting more than a photo op?
Well, it's a great question. Up until now, much of the criticism of American diplomacy in the peace process has focused exactly on that idea that we convene meetings and travel in order to have photo ops. The president, however, in this case, has his name associated with an initiative. This is President Bush's international meeting that he called for in July. And I would imagine that unless he treats this seriously, he is going to face a barrage of criticism, not only in the region where it's expected, but also at home where he doesn't want to hear more criticism about policies in the Middle East. So one could hope that the president is approaching this meeting as well as other meetings up at the UN this week with a great degree of seriousness to see if the meeting itself in November can actually be pulled off.
You were ambassador to Israel for 4 years, and obviously this is something you spent quite a bit of time thinking about. But I feel like there are just often stories about where the peace process is at, what sort of negotiations are going on. Is this something you think that can ever actually be fixed, or is it just about trying to have it be as unacrimonious as possible?
Well, there certainly are levels of engagement that we've seen over the past years. In fact, I've been directing a project at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington, which will result in a publication later this year on U.S. efforts in the peace process. And what it will indicate is that conflict management, the idea that the conflict can't be resolved, conflict management simply doesn't work because we may think that we know how to manage it. But people out in the region have a way of making things worse from day to day. And you end up managing a conflict that's spiraling downhill. On the other hand, on those occasions when you've seen very determined presidential leadership with a determined peace effort, we've actually made progress. Back in the late 70s was progress with Egypt toward a peace treaty. In the 90s, a peace treaty with Jordan, and helping to create conditions that, at least in the 90s, we thought were going to lead to a comprehensive settlement. So it's not just a pie-eyed optimism of diplomats that suggests that this can be resolved. It's actually a very significant national interest of the United States.
Well, Daniel Kurtzer, I hope we can have you back to discuss Hamas's role in this in a future date. Daniel Kurtzer, Chair of Middle East Policy Studies at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy and International Affairs at Princeton University. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, horse slaughter in America. There's still a place where they were doing it, all that may have changed as of Friday.
And something a little more cheery, Bill Wolf with sports coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
Along with Allison Stewart.
Well, you know, it might be news you can use, it might not be, but either way, it's time for something that we like to call the ramble.
Okay, this goes into the category of, that's just not right. Well, TMZ sent out birthday greetings to Paul Hamm today. You might remember him, a gymnast and 2004 Olympic gold medalist. He turns 25 today. Now, that's not the bad part. The bad part is that Paul Hamm has a twin brother who's also a gymnast who TMZ just didn't wish happy birthday to. Just failed to mention that he exists.
As a twin, he was, I presume, born on the same day.
That's the way that works, yeah.
Yes. Happy birthday to everyone who's won a gold medal. And if you didn't,
even if you haven't, it's okay.
You're dead to
us. Morgan Hamm, happy birthday to you.
Well, you know, the Chicago Cubs mania is sweeping the city. They are pulling ahead in the their division of baseball. But you know you're a serious Cubs fan when you name your kid Wrigley Fields. Of course, Wrigley Field is the place where the Cubs play. Born September 12th at Indiana Hospital to Paul and Terry Fields of Michigan City, Indiana.
But they have normal names. That's not right to do to your kid.
Yeah, I guess they just figured their last name was Fields.
Gotta go for it.
With it. So they named their kid Wrigley. They actually, though, said that I think the kid's middle name is Alexander. Okay. And they said that the Wrigley could go by Alexander. If he chose to.
After he gets out of therapy.
Yeah, exactly. Go Cubs.
Diane Sawyer has snagged a huge interview. Jenna Bush. That's kind of a big deal to get the president's daughter. She, of course, has a new book out for teens. It's called Anna's Story. And she's engaged. So we'll have to wait till Friday, though. Apparently the interview's already been taped to find out about the engagements. Find out about the book. Find out about all that stuff that you've read on Wonkette. Won't go any farther than that.
Is that your way of telling me to leave off with that other stuff?
Yes.
How sudden the engagement was, and how quickly it happened, and
she
unexpectedly. Well, I guess maybe we can get her on in 9 months. Maybe we can get her on the Bryant Park Project 9 months from now. Genghis Khan in the news. Well, actually, an Australian guy, Tim Cope. He just finished his trek. He spent 3 years following the exact path of Genghis Khan from Mongolia to Hungary. He rode on horseback. He had a couple horses with him to carry the supplies. Along the journey, his father died in a car accident.
Aww.
His girlfriend, got married to someone else. Rough. His hunting dog was stolen, only to be later found locked in a mine shaft, nearly frozen to death. And this guy, Tim Cope, brought his dog back to life by feeding him raw eggs and vodka.
That's a combo.
That might not be a bad eye-opener here on the DPP on a Monday morning. Okay, but the bigger story to me is Genghis Khan. You notice how I said I didn't say Genghis
Khan? I know, you said like Jenga, like that game that we used to play.
And I spent my whole life saying Genghis Khan, like I think most people do. Yes. And then I listened to All Things Considered, where I heard Robert Siegel, knower of all knowing, say this.
Genghis Khan.
Then I looked it up this morning on this website, yourdictionary.com, and here's how they said it's pronounced.
Genghis Khan.
Genghis Khan. It's one of those things where if you say it right, you sound like an idiot because everyone else is saying it wrong.
We were talking about Vincent van Gogh.
Right.
Edward Munch.
Bach. So I just want to lay it down here.
All those throat clearers.
Right. On the Bryant Park Progress, he will be and forever will be known as Genghis Khan. And if you don't like it, sorry. Robert Siegel says that's how you say it. And that is good enough for me.
Good enough for me, too. And that is good enough for the ramble for this Monday. For sports fans, it was a great weekend. For spouses of sports fans, it was another opportunity to attempt bonding over some games which some people play something somewhere. Okay, Luke, you know how much a sports lover my husband is?
I have him getting an inkling.
He actually was watching a bunch of games, and he stopped on a competition with dogs doing like a triathlon.
Oh, yeah.
Carrying things
that
in their mouth. That's when I thought, this man is a man who loves competition. Bill Wolf, my Monday morning quarterback, joins us. You didn't think I saw that, did you?
I had money on it, baby.
Yeah, what was the over-under on Mr. Wiggles?
They were leaping yellow labs. I had one called Pookie, and I had bet the under. We'll talk later, baby.
All right.
It's a money issue.
Here's what I know about the Chicago Cubs, that some guy wasn't allowed to bring his goat in a bar, and that's why they're cursed and they don't win. But now they're doing well?
They are once again doing well. Like Haley's Comet, the Chicago Cubs come around every so often. You know, 1969, they almost won it. 1984, they should have won it.
It being the World Series, right?
Well, they should have. Yeah, they should have won the World Series. They were the best team, and circumstances conspired to halt their progress prior to grabbing the brass ring, as it were. And the last time was 2003. You may recall they were 5 outs away from clinching the pennant and going to the World Series.
Of course, I recall.
And a fellow called Bartman,
Steve Bartman,
interfered with a foul ball. And from there, everything went really badly for the Cubs. So they're back, and over the weekend, they played the Pittsburgh Pirates, who are worthy of love, actually, and swept them and pulled way ahead in the National League Central. So it appears now that the Chicago Cubs, who last year were atrocious, are going to be in the postseason tournament, the playoffs. And I would venture to guess, in my view, in a very weak league, the National League, the Cubs have as good a chance as anybody to go to and win the World Series.
If they manage to get to the World Series and win it, they need to let this guy Steve Bartman throw out the first pitch or something. They need to bring him out and give him a collective hug, because this dude is personally responsible for the last 4 years of futility.
He had to leave Chicago. He had to move away.
Yeah, seriously.
No joke. He had to move away. And people, it happened in October, and Halloween followed shortly thereafter. And many people in Chicago turned Bartman, who wore like a hooded sweatshirt,
a baseball
and he
cap,
had headphones on. They turned him into some sort of ironic Halloween costume. And he was so harassed that he had to leave the city of Chicago. So if they win, poor Bartman, or Bartman the Hero, as he's known to Cardinal fans, will be canonized at last.
I knew you'd work that in there somehow. So Friday night, I basically just fell asleep while you were...
I'm such incredible company.
Because you were watching the national soap opera that is the Yankees and Red Sox?
I was. I don't even have a dog in the fight. I hate them both so very much. I feel like there is a whole huge country out there. But on the toenail of the big toe, we have New York and Boston, and everybody seems to think it's the only thing that matters. And because we live in New York or Boston, you know, I get caught up in it. So, yes, I was watching the Yankees and the Red Sox over the weekend.
I was really focused on the Red Sox pitcher, the Japanese pitcher, but apparently I'm supposed to pay attention to Jabba Chamberlain.
Yeah,
instead?
Everybody's sort of paying attention to Jabba Chamberlain. He's an amazing story. A 21-year-old kid out of the University of Nebraska, Native American. His father is disabled, and but raised the kid. And the kid is a big, innocent, sweet kid who throws the ball like a howitzer. I mean, he throws it hard, and it moves, and it's frightening. And he's essentially unhittable. And you start the weekend, you never know how you're going to come out of the weekend. You know, if the Yankees had lost 3 to the Blue Jays and the Red Sox had won 3 from the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, you know, it would be over. The Red Sox would have won the division. But instead, the Yankees had more success than the Red Sox over the weekend. And now we have the Yankees are a game and a half behind. They have only one more loss than the Red Sox. We've got about 6 or 7 games to play here the last week of the season. And the Red Sox are in danger of blowing a 14.5 game lead, which they held on May 29th, to the Yanks, who would then win the division title for like the 12th straight year or something like that. So this could go down in history as one of the all-time chokes by the Red Sox, just in terms of its volume. It's hard to choke on something this big.
You told me that I have a team that I should be rooting for. You gave me a long explanation about why I should be rooting for the Green Bay Packers. Now, if you're like me and not really a sports fan, you know the Green Bay Packers, Brett Favre, from Something About Mary.
Yeah.
Brett Favre.
Yeah, you should. Everyone should root for the Green Bay Packers.
Why?
Absolutely.
Because Green Bay, Wisconsin, is about the size of, well, it's smaller than Worcester, Massachusetts, for your reference, or it's sort of the size of Bellingham, Washington, if you're up there in Seattle.
Oh, thank you, Bill.
My pleasure. It's a tiny little town. There are no, this tallest building is a hotel that's 4 stories tall. It has an elevator, and that's kind of a tourist attraction. There's nothing going on in Green Bay, and it's not a suburb of Milwaukee. It's a freestanding small town, and in this freestanding small town, darling Allison, is a National Football League team, which is like having a movie studio or a real Broadway play. The NFL teams are in huge media markets, not in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So the Green Bay Packers are the only relic of the original Pro Football League, which had teams like Canton, Ohio, and Akron, Ohio, and Fort Wayne, Indiana. Green Bay is the only one that survived.
And they're owned by the citizens. They're publicly owned.
Oh, really?
Then they are owned by the town. And that is one of the greatest things in the world. It is a genuine populist thing.
And they're playing really well.
Well, they've been lousy for a number of years, and their quarterback, you know his name,
Brett Favre,
is old. And
how old? What does old mean?
He's 38, maybe?
Football old. That's football old. And
okay.
For a quarterback.
Remember, he's been being pummeled for the last 17 years. He's been in the equivalent of a car accident every week of the fall for the last 17 years. So he's not just long in the tooth. He's sore of the bones and internal organs. So he's diminished, and everyone has said for quite some time he should retire. He should go out gracefully. He was great one time, but he's not great anymore. Well, we've played 3 games now, or I should say they've played. I've played no games ever in my life. But anyway, they've played 3 games now in the season, and they are 3 victories and 0 defeats, and Brett Favre is having a brilliant year. Yesterday they beat the San Diego Chargers, who were expected to be one of the elite teams in the league. And Favre and his mates there in Green Bay at Lambeau Field, the tallest building in Green Bay, beat them 31-24, and Favre had a great day. And if you root for David over Goliath, then the only choice is the Green Bay Packers. That really is America's team. In all of professional sports, the Green Bay Packers are America's.
They're the anti-Yankees.
Team.
They're the opposite of
the
Yankees.
The opposite of the New York Yankees.
Now I understand why you love them so much.
Oh, come on. They're a small Midwestern town with a pro football team. Oh, they're so great. Root for the Packers.
All right, drama from his stepmama, Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Yeah.
Got a new number because his stepmama wouldn't let him keep his old number?
Well, yeah, the stepmama part is really years old, and the story of her not letting him have his old number is a few weeks old. The news this week is that Dale Earnhardt Jr., who's the most famous but not the most successful NASCAR driver, He's been driving number 8, the 8 car, sponsored by Budweiser, and it's a Chevrolet. All of that is very important in NASCAR culture. And he left the team begun by his father, which was called Dale, which still is called Dale Earnhardt Incorporated.
You got 1 minute, honey.
And he left and went to another team. And he wanted to take number 8 with him because he has that as his identity. But his stepmother, Teresa, who was the wife of his father upon his father's death, who runs Dale Earnhardt Incorporated, said, no, if you're leaving for another team, you cannot have number 8, which was a very bitter pill for Dale Earnhardt to swallow. It was a very Southern Gothic family melodrama. So this week, the big news, even though Dale Earnhardt Jr. is not the best driver, is that on his new team, he has a new number. And it's a big enough deal that they had a press conference, and it was kind of the lead story in the sports world for about a day. And the number is 88. And why is that important? Because so many Dale Earnhardt fans have 8 tattooed into their skin permanently, indelibly into their skin. Now they can just add an 8, and it isn't ruined that it can still be Dale Earnhardt Jr. fan. And he will be sponsored by a new energy drink full of caffeine and
pep
and the National Guard.
Well,
I don't know anything more about Dale Earnhardt, but that was some fast talking.
A fast talking man in my life, my Monday morning quarterback, yeah, Bill Wolf.
I got to eat some raw eggs and drink some vodka.
All right. Have a great day. I'll see you later.
Right. See you, babe.
Thank you.
Well, it's the end of an era that a lot of people may not have even actually known about. The last horse slaughterhouse in the U.S. has been effectively closed for business because of a state law banning horse meat for human consumption. You may not have known there were any horse slaughterhouses here. It's probably because most Americans don't eat horse meat, of course. Belgians do, though, and the Belgian-owned company Caval International had a slaughterhouse just outside of Chicago in DeKalb. Now, there were 2 other slaughterhouses which stopped processing horses in Texas earlier this year. They were shut down by similar bans. These bans were spearheaded by animal rights groups like the Humane Society. Now, lots of animals are slaughtered, of course, all over the U.S. all the time, but the idea of horses being killed, it really gets people's emotions going. I actually found this out a couple summers ago when I covered congressional debate on banning horse slaughter. It was just a little 5-minute story, but I must have gotten 200 emails in response. Because, you know, it just...
My nieces are equestrians. I can imagine. They whenever they walk by Central Park and they even see the horses who have the blinders on or in the park, they get all upset.
Right, yeah. So the closure, though, of this slaughterhouse does kind of raise one question, which is what to do with the 90 to 100,000 horses in the country every year that people actually want to get rid of? What's going to happen to them? Well, on the line, we've got Dr. Belinda Thompson. She's a veterinarian and she's on the faculty at Cornell University. She also had a mixed large animal private practice for 20 years. Dr. Thompson, thanks for coming on the Bryant Park Project.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what kind of horses actually end up in a slaughterhouse?
Well, actually, all kinds of horses end up in a slaughterhouse. The horses that end up there represent the entire population of horses with all uses, athletic work, private ownership, and even the companion animal side of horse ownership.
And are these generally horses that are just broken down and really old, or they're just horses that are young and people don't want them?
They're generally referred to as the population of horses that become unwanted, although there's a small segment of horses that are specifically raised for the meat industry.
And so horses were being brought to these various slaughterhouses. They're not going to be brought there anymore. What's then going to happen to a horse that somebody doesn't want? Do they kill them? Do they just leave them in the pasture?
That's a really huge question, because once a horse becomes unwanted, there may be issues with the economic support of that horse or the ability to provide a humane end for that horse. That the slaughterhouse filled, it was a niche that the slaughterhouse filled in some cases.
Did you agree with the slaughterhouses existing, or did you think they were a bad thing?
I did agree with the need for a humane end for these horses, and I did believe that the slaughterhouse industry provided a humane alternative to allowing horses to continue a life of either discomfort and pain and possibly neglect, abandonment, inappropriate care, etc. The American Association of Equine Practitioners issued a policy statement that the American Veterinary Medicine Association endorsed, advocating the humane treatment of all horses and addressing the inhumane treatment of unwanted horses.
So in essence, you thought that these slaughterhouses, even though they were sort of a gruesome thought, served some kind of purpose.
Well, it may be difficult for people to understand, but the actual rendering of the death in the slaughterhouse, the means by which that was accomplished was the use of a penetrating captive bolt device, and that's actually considered a humane euthanasia technique by the American Veterinary Medicine Association because it renders the animal unconscious instantly. And it's considered as acceptable as a barbiturate injection or a gunshot or some other means of acceptable euthanasia. The AVMA has standards for that. The issue for most people was the way the horse got to the slaughterhouse and how it may have been handled in the slaughterhouse before the moments where the horse was killed.
Because the Humane Society and others would allege that the horses were being brought to these slaughterhouses in containment devices that were not really designed for horses and not designed for long hauls. And so it was the getting to the slaughterhouse that was particularly unpleasant for the horses.
Yes, and those transport mechanisms were actually outlawed in the United States. For example, the use of double-decker transport trucks that are considered acceptable for cattle, but because of the difference in temperament of horses, are entirely unsuitable for the transportation of horses.
So what happens now? It's the last horse slaughterhouse is probably closed down. Is this going to make the end of life worse for horses in America?
It may be for some horses, and that's a concern to all veterinarians and particularly equine veterinarians. There are areas of the country that are not serviced by equine veterinarians where veterinarians may not be available in a timely way to euthanize horses. There are certainly most horse owners are not trained in administering any kind of humane euthanasia techniques, whereas the workers in the slaughterhouse who actually did that had training to do it and felt confident that they could do it properly. And so there are a lot of issues of what's going to happen to these 90,000 horses every year.
Dr. Belinda Thompson, veterinarian on the faculty at Cornell University, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, grammar lovers, they're mourning today the hyphen. It is getting the boot. We'll explain.
Also, we'll talk about a fellow in Seattle named Walt Crowley. He passed away from cancer on Friday. Before he had a very major surgery, though, I had a conversation with him about losing his voice. You're going to want to hear. A guy who wasn't famous, but had a big impact on the city of Seattle. That's coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. You can always find us online at npr.org/Bryant Park. Hey, everybody. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, it's a little black line, goes between words, and when it's gone, a lot of people won't miss it. But the gradual loss of the hyphen has some grammarians red hyphen hot mad. See how I did that? Actually, how Trisha McKinney did that. We're going to talk to some self-described grammar vandal. Only on NPR would we get a bad boy grammar vandal. That's coming up in a few minutes. First, though, let's hear about today's top news stories from our news hyphen caster. That's not even where a hyphen would really go.
Not really. All right. It's good for the joke.
Thank you. Rachel Martin's here.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Iraq's government today said no action would be taken against the U.S. private security firm Blackwater until a joint investigation between Iraqi and U.S. officials is complete. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki had vowed to freeze Blackwater's operations in Iraq. He also wants to prosecute Blackwater's staff over what he termed a flagrant assault 8 days ago in which Blackwater guards shot and killed as many as 20 civilians. Blackwater insists its guards reacted lawfully to an attack on a U.S. convoy. The shooting in western Baghdad angered many Iraqis who see the thousands of private security guards working throughout Iraq as private armies who act with impunity. An order drafted after the 2003 U.S. invasion gives private security firms immunity. And in other international news, it's been 7 days and the monks in Myanmar are still marching. It's the largest pro-democracy demonstration in Myanmar, also known as Burma, in about 20 years. Today, about 100,000 people protested outside the Defense Ministry building, calling for the release of Aung San Suu Kyi, the pro-democracy leader who's been under house arrest for the past 12 years. It's the seventh straight day of protests. Myanmar's military government has sealed off the country to foreign journalists, but information about the protests has been flowing through wire reports and exiled democracy groups. The military regime in Myanmar crushed a national uprising in 1988, killing an estimated 3,000 civilians. And the German government has given up trying to hold 13 CIA agents accountable for allegedly kidnapping a German citizen in the Balkans 4 years ago. Earlier this year, a German court ordered the arrest of the 13 operatives on suspicion of kidnapping Khaled El-Masri, a German citizen of Lebanese descent. El-Masri says the CIA agents abducted him while he was vacationing in Macedonia, then flew him to Afghanistan where he was imprisoned for months and tortured. Last month, German officials asked the U.S. to extradite the CIA agents so they could be charged in the kidnapping. The U.S. said no. The case drew international attention to the CIA practice known as extraordinary rendition, when suspected terrorists are detained and flown to third-party countries to be interrogated. El-Masri sued the CIA in U.S. courts, but his complaint was dismissed last year on the grounds that it could harm national security. And it's Monday, so we talk a little bit about the movies. And lots of folks went to see Resident Evil Extinction, which was number one at the box office, bringing in $24 million in ticket sales. I mean, really, Mila Jovovich and flesh-eating zombies. That is some good movie stuff. Coming in second was the debut of Good Luck Chuck, the romantic comedy with Jessica Alba and Dane Cook. And last weekend's big winner, The Brave One, with Jodie Foster, fell to third place, ranking in $7.4 million. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
My vote is for 310 to Yuma. If you haven't seen it, the Christian Bale, Russell Crowe, Western.
Westernish, yeah.
It's really intense. I mean, it's kind of the Christ story, ultimately, but it's really beautifully filmed, and they are fantastic. And then you suddenly realize they're also not American when they're doing this incredible sort of...
It's on my list.
It's good.
It's on my list. It's playing right around the corner from my house. Well, he certainly wasn't a famous guy, even in his adopted hometown of Seattle. But late last week, when Walt Crowley died at age 60, a little piece of that city's history kind of went with him. Crowley founded the website historylink.org, which is a repository for all things historical in Washington State and the Emerald City. Walt Crowley was also a local gadfly. He was a regular TV and radio personality. He would pop up on these shows, and he would kind of defend this grumpy, rumpled kind of populism that runs through Seattle. I just remember being a kid and seeing him on TV arguing for the preservation of these various historic things in Seattle. and being a little scared of him, actually. And then anyway, I ended up hosting an NPR show called Day to Day. Found out that Walt Crowley ended up with throat cancer. The doctors told him that his best shot at survival was to have his voice box removed. So for that show, Day to Day, I actually interviewed him just before he had that surgery, which would render him speechless for the rest of his life. Here's what he had to say.
So have you been savoring, you know, every word this week? Because or has it really sunk in?
Well, no, it's sunk in, I guess. Although there's always the shock of the reel. That we'll save that for waking up Saturday morning.
What do you think you're going to miss about talking the way you've been talking for your entire life, which is going to change?
Well, you're going to lose that ability to just, you know, throw off a quip. But, you know, I've had, my voice has been compromised for a variety of reasons for the last 5 or 6 years, not just the cancer and a number of things. So I've kind of gotten used to biting my tongue. It's pretty well scarred. And so I may chomp down on it a little harder after this. But I guess the key thing I want to stress is that losing my natural voice does not mean I lose the ability to communicate, and obviously there's multiple means these days for that, with the internet and, you know, my website history link and text messaging and emails and all of that. But also there are artificial means. It's called an electrolarynx, and it generates vibration in your mouth, so then you can, you know, basically speak normally, but it's a kind of a mechanical monotone. So you sound like Stephen W. Hawking, ergo the smartest guy in the room. So what's wrong with that?
Do you feel like if it was going to happen, this is as good a time as any because of actually how much we use all those other modes of communication?
Very much so. I the technology today, for, if you will, non-vocal or non-oral communication is so rich and flexible and portable that, I guess the parents of many a teenager will testify to the fact they never use their voice. They're text messaging all the time.
I have to say, and I mean this with the greatest amount of respect, Walt, but you're a guy who, when I was young and watching you on TV, I thought, this is a guy who's kind of grumpy. And do you think this has changed you as a person and the response you've gotten from people?
Yes. It is weird to say it. The experience of the last 18 months with cancer and the treatment and whatever has actually, in some ways, been the most inspiring and moving experience of my life. And it has brought me much closer to a lot of people.
Have you thought about what the absolute last words that you're going to say are before they shoot you up with whatever they shoot you up with?
I doubt if I could say them on public radio.
Why don't you give it a try? We can always we can bleep it out.
It would involve some sexual acts, some historic religious leaders. No, I don't think I want to get you in trouble with the FCC.
Well, that's very big of you.
Walt Crowley died on Friday night from a stroke related to another surgery he'd undergone to fight his cancer. He was 60 years old.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, the hyphen gets the boot. 16,000 words with their hyphen removed. The outrage. We'll get to it coming up.
I don't even know how to use a hyphen.
The latest edition of the shorter Oxford English Dictionary will be a little lighter on ink. The hyphen has been dumped. not all together, but about 16,000 words have had the hyphen removed and are now either one word like pigeonhole or two words like fig leaf. Staff at the OED says this is how society has progressed, using 5% fewer hyphens in the past 30 years. I can't believe someone counts that up. Are you in shock and horror side of this grammatical movement, or do you say, go with the flow, language evolves? Well, before you make up your mind, let's check in with Kate McCulley, author of the blog Grammar Vandal. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
So why do you think the hyphen was given the old heave-ho?
Well, honestly, if you look at the words that they use, I personally don't use a hyphen in any of these words. I think it's just the natural evolution of language. For example, back in the day, today and tomorrow always used a hyphen. These days, I never use a hyphen on pigeonhole. I never use a hyphen on makeover.
How often do you write pigeonhole?
I never use a hyphen on fig leaf. I always write pigeonhole as one word.
You use pigeonhole a lot in your daily life there?
Time to time. I am a writer.
Just so we understand, can you give us a couple of other examples of hyphenless words now?
Hyphenless words, oh God, off the top of today and tomorrow as something that is historically. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure if off the top of my head I can think of some words.
While you think about that, let's go all the way back to the beginning. What was the original job of the hyphen?
Well, it was to bring two words that traditionally weren't used together. And to this day, it's often used between a noun and a verb. For example, award-winning. You can't just write award-winning. You need to use the hyphen because it was winning of an award.
And when did it start to become clear that this little guy just not that useful anymore?
Well, like you said, language evolves. And I definitely think that hyphens are underused in general writing today. But I think that what the Oxford English Dictionary did was actually pretty smart, because we don't use hyphens in most of the words that they took words away from.
Apparently the word email may be one of the culprits, and that email itself may be one of the big issues, that we're communicating so rapidly, so quickly now. What do you think about that premise?
Well, first of all, in terms of email, first of all, I'm an AP girl through and through, AP style.
Mm-hmm.
But email is one word that I will always write as one word. I think that we've gotten to the point where email is not a fad. It's not a temporary thing. It's permanent. And I don't think that we need that E hyphen clarifying that it's mail, but electronically. Email has become its own entity by now. It's very strong, and for that reason, I think that email can just be written without a hyphen.
Now, are there other punctuation marks or issues you feel are on the endangered list at this point?
You know, I don't think that anything's outright endangered, but I do think that people don't use the semicolon nearly as often as they should. And I wouldn't be surprised if perhaps a generation down the road or so, the semicolon ends up getting phased out.
And I have to ask you about your title of Grammar Vandal. I got to be honest.
Hardcore.
That one, I don't understand. Could you explain it to me?
Yes. Well, it began a few months ago. I saw a blatant error on an advertisement.
Uh-huh.
So I took an adhesive comma and I added it.
What was the ad?
It was a Reebok ad. It said, "Run easy, Boston." Just run easy, Boston, period. I took a comma and put it after easy. Run easy, Boston.
How many of these commas did you put up?
Oh, there was only one sign that I actually did that to that was within my reach. But ever since then, I've done some other things. There's a sign in my neighborhood for Professor's Row, the street.
It's not possessive.
Just the word professor. So I took an apostrophe and I put it after the S.
You know what's so funny about that Reebok ad? They ran it in New York. And they had one of the ads was not everything has to be hard. And they misspelled everything. And I put a photo of it on our blog.
Stop.
This was a very problematic. Yeah, really. Yeah. If you go to npr.org/Bryant Park, you can see I took it with my cell phone. They have misspelled the word everything. They've written it everything. This was a very problematic campaign for Reebok on multiple levels.
You got to think, the reason why I don't pick on regular people the way they speak, but I pick on advertisers because, come on, they have a team of editors, and advertisements are looked at millions and millions of times before they're printed. And come on, you couldn't hire a decent copy editor?
What do you think, just because we're on the subject of grammar vandalization, what do you think are some of the most egregious and common grammatical errors? What are the things that really get you annoyed?
One thing that really bothers me is when people write the word every day as one word. You can use every day as one word, but in meaning typical or usual or ordinary. But when people mean to say each day and they just write every day as one word, that is an advertisement everywhere. And
it just gets terrible. You steamed. Kate McCulley, yeah. I don't know if they say good hyphen bye or goodbye or goodbye. But
just one word, no hyphens.
Okay.
It's free. And if you're interested, be sure to visit thegrammarvandal.com.
I will go there once again today.
Mm-hmm.
Kate McCulley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, Allison, you talk to your husband on this program. That's actually part of the deal.
Yeah.
But late last week, Rudy Giuliani, who's running for president, as you well know, had a moment which seemed like a moment of candor when he was talking to the NRA. And, of course, the backstory is that the NRA is very suspicious of Rudy Giuliani because he's had a pretty liberal stance on
it. Right. And all the candidates have been going to speak. And you've had Fred Thompson talking about his long history as a hunter and Mitt Romney trying to talk about his history as a hunter for the past 6 months.
Right.
And Rudy Giuliani, obviously, has been tough on guns because he was the mayor of New York City.
Right. So now he has to go try to make nice with the NRA. And he goes and he's giving this big speech. And in the middle of the speech, what happens but...
Just think of the language of it. The language of it is, the people shall be secure. Let's see now. This is my wife calling, I think. Hello, dear. I'm talking to the members of the NRA right now. Would you like to say hello? I love you, and I'll give you a call as soon as I'm finished, okay? Okay. Have a safe trip. Bye-bye. Talk to you later, dear. I love you.
Oh, sweet. Except that, as the New York Times noted, he had a remarkably similar incident a few months ago in Miami.
Which either means it was staged or Mrs. Giuliani calls him a lot.
Yeah, seriously.
At inappropriate moments. And apparently doesn't have her husband's schedule. Because
yeah, can they sync up their Outlook account or something so she knows when he's speaking to people? I mean, part of the knock on Rudy Giuliani is that he's a tough guy, but maybe he's not quite human enough.
Mm-hmm.
So some people have been speculating that he's been staging these kind of faux authentic moments with his wife. Oh, the old ball and chain.
Or perhaps all too human is that is his third wife.
Mm-hmm.
We've all heard the issues about that. One divorce, one annulment. Number three, maybe it's the charm.
Well, if he does it again, or if it happens again, I think we're officially seeing some kind of choreographed event.
I think she needs to learn a text message. Exactly. That would work out a lot better, I think.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Blogging online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart.
From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
It is Monday, September 24th. You're listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Thank you for doing that, by the way. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. Allison, it looks like the end of an era.
What's going on, Luke Burbank?
Well, Barry Bonds, just became news over the weekend. He is not going to be re-signed by the San Francisco Giants after this season.
Why not?
Well, nobody knows exactly why, but I think it has something to do with the fact that he's a total defensive liability when he plays the outfield, and that every time you go to a visiting stadium, people throw crap at you.
Yeah.
And, you know,
those are good enough reasons for me, right there.
They wanted him to get his record, and he did, and now he might play for someone else, which would be kind of a surreal experience.
Hey, in New York City, there are so many police officers on the street right now. I came to work this morning.
Down 42nd
they are everywhere. Why? Well, the UN General Assembly's in town, and also, the president of Iran is here. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, we're going to find out how he's perceived at home, as well as Columbia's campus, where he's going to speak this afternoon.
Also, a Newt Gingrich sighting. He says he might run for president if his supporters
can
come up
make him sound like Punxsutawney Phil.
Four more years of political campaigning if Newt Gingrich seizes. He says that he is going to run for president if his supporters pony up $30 million, which is a novel attempt at fundraising. We'll see if that kind of works out.
Also, web doctor, this young doctor, he has a service where online you pay a flat fee, and then he will basically diagnose you via email and via web video. We want to know, is this possibly legal? What's the malpractice insurance like? Why is he doing it? He's actually going to come by the studios.
And we'll talk about the video game Halo 3, which is coming out today. I really could not care less about it, which makes a perfect candidate for making me care. We're going to talk to a guy who's actually played the game. We're also going to get today's top stories from our newscaster, Rachel Martin, in just a minute. First, though, we're going to take a look at the BPP's big story. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has arrived in New York. He's scheduled to speak at Columbia University later today and at the UN General Assembly tomorrow. The visit has, of course, been a source of controversy and protests for several days now. Many people tried to pressure Columbia to cancel his appearance there, as they did the last time Columbia scheduled him to speak a year ago. But the school announced Friday it would proceed as planned. Ahmadinejad appeared on CBS's 60 Minutes last night, where he was interviewed by Scott Pelley. Pelley asked about the Iranian president's request to visit Ground Zero, and Ahmadinejad professed to be, quote, amazed when Pelley suggested Americans would be insulted by his desire to lay a wreath there. Ahmadinejad also maintained that Iran does not sponsor terrorism, is not attempting to acquire nuclear weapons, and is not supplying weapons to insurgents in Iraq. The Iranian president blamed reports to these effects on misinformation disseminated by the American government. Here is a small taste of that interview.
Mr. President, I want to be very direct and very clear. Many Americans believe that you have American blood on your hands. Are you saying that it is not the policy of this government to send weapons into Iraq? Sir, forgive me, you're smiling, but this is a very serious matter to America.
Well, it's serious for us as well. I dare say it's serious for everyone. I'm just amazed, as the representative of a media, why do you insist on the untrue accusations leveled by your government? This doesn't solve anything. And the reason that I'm smiling again, it's because that the picture is so clear, but American officials refuse to see it.
We're going to get into this whole issue in a lot more detail in a minute. We'll talk with NPR's Robert Smith, who has just wandered into the studio. He's settling in. He's on his way to Columbia campus right now, and we'll talk to the first U.S. newspaper reporter to interview Ahmadinejad. But right now, let's get the rest of today's news from our own Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Good morning, everyone. So it's true, convoys of black sedans decorated with world flags are cruising the streets of New York today. World leaders have descended upon the city for the United Nations General Assembly meeting. Among them, Iran's leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The Iranian president is scheduled to attend the UN meetings this week, and today he'll appear at a talk at Columbia University. Protesters condemn the Iranian leader's repeated denial of the Holocaust and Iran's alleged nuclear program. Tensions between Washington and Tehran keep getting more intense over U.S. accusations that Iran is secretly trying to develop nuclear weapons. Iran denies the claim. Before leaving Iran, Ahmadinejad said the American people have been denied correct information, and his visit will give them a chance to hear a different story. Stay tuned for more details on this coming up next in the show. And on this first day of the UN General Assembly meeting, world leaders will talk global warming. They'll hear from California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger about how the U.S. is joining the effort. Al Gore will be there, so will German Chancellor Angela Merkel and France's President Nicolas Sarkozy. Not President Bush, though. Aides to the president say he'll skip today's meeting, and instead he'll hold his own talks on global warming, held later this week. That meeting will focus on how to let countries set their own climate policies instead of relying on international treaties. The United Auto Workers Union is raising the stakes in its negotiations with General Motors. The union says if its demands aren't met by late this morning, its 73,000 factory workers will walk off the job. In a statement posted on the union's website, the UAW said its decision to set a strike deadline was prompted by General Motors' failure to address job security and other bargaining issues. One of the sticking points is health care for retired workers. GM wants to reduce its $5 billion annual health care bill. The company also wants to hire new workers at a lower wage. The union, meanwhile, wants the company to promise to keep jobs in the U.S. instead of shifting production abroad. And you might have heard the most famous quiet man in the world passed away over the weekend. Marcel Marceau, the French mime, died Saturday in France at the age of 84. Marceau started his career in 1964 and performed an average of 200 shows a year, most of those abroad, where he got more acclaim than he ever did in his native France. He played to full houses in the U.S., around Europe, and in Japan, where he was deemed a national treasure. He was a strong defender of his art, and in 2000, he spoke with NPR's Scott Simon about the ways that mime illustrates human nature.
Is there anything that can't be said on stage in mime?
Well, yes, I think lies are difficult.
Seriously?
Yes, because when you talk, you can lie. And when you play with your body and your soul, you have to be understood immediately, and you have to take the essence of life.
Marceau continued touring well into his 80s until he retired in 2005. The news is always online at npr.org.
Well, so he's not getting...
Back to you, Luke and Allison. Allison's chomping at the bit, clearly.
No, I'm just saying, you're somebody who has not been getting the love in her obituary. Alice Ghostly. Do you remember Esmeralda from Bewitched?
Oh, yeah.
And she played Bernice in Designing Women. She passed away over the weekend. She was like a Tony nominee. She was one of those.
She was the mom in Bewitched. I mean, the stepmother?
Esmeralda with the short red hair.
No, that
was Agnes Moorehead.
Okay.
And she played sort of the ditzy lady on Designing Women. She was a really good actress. I just wanted to give her some love, too. Okay, so I was in this plane yesterday, and a husband turns to his wife and he says, "So, what do you think about the president of Iran speaking at Columbia?" And she announced very loudly to the whole plane, "I believe in discourse." Now turn on my phone, is what she said to her husband.
Her husband turns her phone on for her?
They were hilarious, actually.
Interesting
relationship. The rest of the conversation was something, too. But, you know, a lot of others would not agree with her. Yesterday, Columbia student Ari Gardner was part of a crowd protesting the Iranian president's visit. Here's what Ari had to say.
All of these rights that we enjoy, that we've been raised in America to appreciate, this man stands against. And as he's speaking to us, then students in Iran are being jailed.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad arrived in New York City last night. Today, he will speak at Columbia. Tomorrow, he'll address the UN General Assembly. And then Wednesday, he is out of here. NPR National Desk correspondent Robert Smith is going to cover Ahmadinejad's speech at Columbia. And Robert, you've already spent a little bit of time at Columbia. Can you tell there's a storm coming up there?
Oh, yeah. on Friday, they had papered the campus with all these posters. And you have to give credit to Columbia students. You know, it is part of the Ivy League. Because rather than have these incendiary posters, they simply placed the words of Ahmadinejad on these posters. And then they put photos of public executions in Iran. So there wasn't any comment. It was just sort of, this is the man who's coming. Do what you will. And then later on in the day they put up signs saying, oh, by the way, should this offend you in any way, you can come and protest all day long. We're expecting protests outside the campus, inside the campus, pretty much until he leaves.
Now, have they made a designated protest area, they meaning the university, they meaning the New York Police Department, the way they have it, when there have been various other, maybe things not as controversial as this, but obviously there have been conventions here that people have not agreed with the political views of those attending?
Yeah, there'll be a section inside the campus where I think students are going to do something. More importantly, though, they're sort of locking down the campus because people are traveling for all over. This is going to be a big old crazy time for anyone.
Okay.
You know, for both Jewish groups who protest to the president of Iran's views on Israel and his denial of the Holocaust, plus a lot of right-wing Republican groups who oppose the president for his supposed support of terrorism. They'll all be converging on the campus. And, you know, it's funny, although the police had said earlier in the week, you may remember, that the president could not go to Ground Zero, they are now saying that they will do anything necessary, of course, to keep him safe and to keep the campus calm. So
now,
there'll be a lot of police up there, too.
Who can go to the speech? Who can get tickets? Is it a first come, first serve?
Yeah, nobody anymore. There's not even space for the media. It was. I talked to a kid who had worked on the sign-up table. He had gotten one of the rare tickets. There were about 300 tickets, and he said they were gone in 20 minutes.
Wow.
So people just lined up. Now, you have to remember, this, you know, this is a whole series they're having at Columbia. So there's the president of Chile. You know, also a hot ticket, Malawi,
sure.
Turkmenistan.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't try and get in there, Luke.
I'm already on the list for Turkmenistan.
Malawi, Madonna's bought up the whole front row.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Just for her kids.
Exactly.
Amazing stuff. Hey, Robert, what kind of – so you're actually going to be in the room with Ahmadinejad?
No, I'm going to be outside covering the protests. We're going to have Michelle Kellerman from our foreign desk. She managed to – I shouldn't say this in the air, but she managed to get a rare ticket to get inside.
Was it really, really hard even for the media to get access to this thing?
Well, yeah. They have an overflow room for the media, but even that is full. And so they're going to send a pool feed, they call it. So it's a satellite feed of this speech, which ABC will send out. And so it'll also be available on the internet and YouTube and all of this. There's just such intense interest. And Lerner Hall is not a big hall. This is not Madison Square Garden, which would also be a controversial thing, putting the president up there. So,
what are some of the conditions that Columbia has placed around his visit?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this whole thing started with the Iran mission to the UN sort of approaching Columbia and saying, we can make the president Ahmadinejad available to you. And the president of Columbia knew it was going to be controversial, and he said to them, well, it can't be a speech. It has to be a give and take. It has to be equal amount of talking by Ahmadinejad and questions from the students. And Bullinger himself is going to introduce it and, as he says, sharply rebuke and challenge Ahmadinejad. And he's given a list of questions he's going to say from the very beginning. He's going to challenge him on his views on the state of Israel, on his denial of the Holocaust, on his support of terrorism, on civil rights within Iran. And he's going to do those all up front. Now, if you saw the president of Iran last night on 60 Minutes.
He reacts so well to that.
You know, he smiles. He smiles. He kind of giggles and he dances around the question. And so I don't think this is going to be any great truthful moment where Ahmadinejad breaks down on the stand and starts crying and says, I was wrong. I shouldn't have worn this jacket.
Right. We know how the various political groups feel about the speech at Columbia, but what are the students that you spoke to, what are they actually thinking about? Do they think this is just an incredible opportunity to witness history, or do they really have strong political views either way about his appearance?
Oh, several mentioned the history the phrase, and that's really important to them, because these are people who are going to go into public service, who are going to be the people who are going to be running the State Department in 20 years, and they say, look, this, for good or bad, and of course everyone says they don't agree with his views, but this is a chance to see someone who will change history, who will be a huge factor in the world of the next 5-10 years, and they just want to hear what he has to say. Now, there were a lot of students who also felt, you know, beyond the free speech issues, they were conflicted inside, I'll say. They said, look, it's fine. I know he's going to speak. I know he probably should speak. But they understood that this was something that was going to deeply offend and hurt members of their community, people who were paying for the hall that he's going to be speaking in. And so I watched a lot of students really wrestle with that in their heads, including you know, one young man I talked to, who's he had a family member, a great-grandmother, who had died in the Holocaust. And he's going, And he said, look, you know, it's absolutely wrong. I don't know how he can believe that the Holocaust didn't happen. But, you know, I want to see him. And if possible, I want to ask him about it. And I want to specifically say, look, my great grandmother's dead. You know, you can't deny that. So we'll see.
You're going to have a very interesting afternoon, I think.
It's going to be crazy.
It's going to be a little crazy. Well, be careful.
I will be careful.
Make sure you're
well, that's
okay.
That's what all those police officers
have. That's what they're there for.
Don't get a paper cut from one of those banners people are holding up. Or...
You know, the Ivy League's a tough place.
Easy. NPR's Robert Smith.
Woo, brown grad.
Thanks for coming in. We've been known to be mean.
Another thing that we started talking about the Ahmadinejad stuff is that a lot of people don't actually understand how the government of Iran works. They hear President Ahmadinejad, mm-hmm. and they think that means he's the George Bush of Iran, but he's actually not. And coming up in the next segment, we're going to talk to an American reporter who's actually interviewed Ahmadinejad and kind of can illuminate for us how things really work in Iran, how he's perceived there, and what they're making of this whole kerfuffle.
That's all coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. It is Monday, September 24th, and you are listening to the Bryant Park Project. From NPR News, I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Continuing our conversation about Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit to New York, it's making very big news today. He's scheduled to attend a sort of debate / Q&A at Columbia University tonight, which is the source of much controversy. CNN has been in like rolling coverage on it as we watch it here in the studio. Any person who happens to be walking above 72nd Street is apparently, I don't know, random people they pull off the street, I think.
Columbia student.
I guess.
Okay.
So we though, were interested in finding out a little bit more about how the Iranian government actually works. How much power does Ahmadinejad have to back up his sometimes threatening statements that he's made? What do people think of him in Iran? It's interesting to note that we actually reached out to a couple of Iranian reporters for this conversation, and both of them were kind of reluctant to speak with us because they feared reprisals from the government. One of us told them that the Iranian government actually monitors NPR.
Oh, really?
Just must quadruple our listenership, for one thing. Anyway, we fortunately, though, found someone here in the U.S. who is very qualified to talk about this. Barbara Slavin is senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She's traveled to Iran 6 times and actually was the first U.S. newspaper reporter to interview Ahmadinejad. Barbara Slavin, thanks for coming on the show.
You're quite welcome.
So let's just start off with this. People hear that Ahmadinejad is the president, and I think that they just figure he's George Bush. But how is the Iranian government actually set up? How much power does he actually have?
Yeah, well, he has power, but it's a very, very distant, different system from what we have. It's run by a supreme religious leader, a cleric, a Muslim cleric, and it has been since 1979, since the Iranian Revolution. And the supreme leader is a guy named Ali Khamenei, and he is the one who has the last word on all of these issues. He's in charge of foreign policy. He's the one who appoints the commanders of all the branches of the armed forces. He's the one who, if Iran had a nuclear weapon, would have his finger on the button.
Does Ahmadinejad have any military power then? I mean, he said things like Israel should be wiped off the map. Can he actually direct people to wipe Israel off the map?
No, he can't. But he does sit on a Supreme Council of National Security. He has a lot of allies within the system, so he has an influence. But his biggest influence has been his voice, his big mouth. I mean, coming to the United States is a dream for him because he gets to go to the UN and he's got this incredible megaphone where he can say things that have affected Iran. A lot of people say that if not for him, we wouldn't have all these sanctions against Iran, because every time he opens his mouth and makes these kinds of statements, he does the neoconservatives in this country a favor. He makes their case for them.
I read in your piece, though, that some of this is causing a bit of consternation in Iran among people who are basically saying, people in the government saying, look, bro, you're making this a lot harder on us.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an open secret. I mean, Iranians, educated Iranians, Iranians who are of different political persuasion, and there are plenty of them in Iran, I assure you, you know, they're mortified by him. And they understand that he's really doing a disservice to his country. And I think he doesn't get it. Or maybe he does. Who knows?
The supreme leader there, though, who it sounds like has most of the actual power, does he back Ahmadinejad? He would have to, I guess, right?
He does and he doesn't. You know, Ahmadinejad, I say, has performed a sort of useful service for the supreme leader as well. The last Iranian president was a man named Mohammad Khatami, very well educated, spoke English, spoke German, someone who did not use this kind of warlike language at all. And compared to Khatami, Khamenei looked like a warmonger, a hardliner, a conservative. But compared to this president, Khamenei looks moderate, sensible, the wise older man. So everybody says that he likes having him around, you know, as a kind of foil, because he looks better in comparison. And he can decide whether he supports the president or he doesn't. He can go issue by issue. So he's useful in that sense to the supreme leader.
Can you remind everybody how Ahmadinejad rose to power?
Well, you know, this is his first elected office.
He started with getting his PhD in traffic management,
right.
I understand.
Something like
right?
that, yeah.
And he was a revolutionary back in the day.
Yeah, he was a revolutionary, although not a very distinguished one, not one of the more important ones. You know, there was a big kerfluffle about whether he was involved in the taking of U.S. hostages, and some of the former hostages said, oh, yeah, he was there. Well, he wasn't there. If he had been a ringleader, he would have put it on his resume. He would have bragged about it because it's kind of a point of pride for Iranian revolutionaries. So he was part of the student movement at that time, but he actually argued for taking over the Russian embassy, because he was more anti-communist than anti-American at that time. I think he was really formed not just by the revolution, but by the Iran-Iraq War. He was a soldier, a member of the Revolutionary Guard in the Iran-Iraq War, and that was a dreadful war. Iran lost more than 300,000 dead, many, many more wounded. And I think his anti-Americanism really developed during that war, because the U.S. supported Iraq.
But he's not a tremendously worldly guy, though, right?
No,
rarely been out of Iran.
He had a bunch of appointed posts. He was appointed the mayor of Tehran after conservatives took over the city council there. And then he ran for president, and some people say there was some fraud involved. He got through to a second round of voting, and in this final runoff, he ran against a former president who's one of Iran's wealthiest men, is reputed to be very corrupt. And so he won on a sort of protest vote. This is his first elected office. He's been, apart from New York, I think he's been to Tokyo maybe once when he was mayor of Tehran. He spent his whole life, not just in Tehran, but in one little neighborhood in Tehran.
Wow. You've actually met him, though, sat across the table from him. What's he like?
Well, you know, he's getting a little more polished. I watched him on 60 Minutes. He's beginning to figure out how to do this. But when I met him, it was in February of 2006, and he was still pretty rough around the edges. He's very dogmatic, you know. He likes to answer questions with questions. He doesn't really listen. Seems to be very sure of himself and his opinions. And he's a very narrow-minded person.
If he runs for re-election in 2009, do you think he'll get re-elected?
I think a lot depends on what the international situation is. A lot depends on the economic situation. Right now, that's his real Achilles heel. The economy is in just rotten shape. They have inflation 15, maybe 20, 25% now. Still very high joblessness, particularly for young people. And it's people are tired of him. They were getting tired of him even in 2006, and he'd only been in office for 6 months.
Well, we'll see how New York receives him today. Barbara Slavin, senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today, also the author of the forthcoming book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Also one of the first people in the U.S. to interview Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Thanks a lot, Barbara Slavin.
You're welcome.
I'd like to take the opportunity every day to find out what the people have on their minds, what stories that they are viewing the most online, they're emailing the most, the terms they're...
You just headbutted the microphone. That's how excited you are.
I'm so excited about finding out about the pulse of America and the world. Hey, Tricia McKinney, our editor, has joined us in the studio for her most pick of the day. Tricia?
This is the most emailed at the Arizona Republic, and apparently in Arizona they're big on copper.
Well, I mean, we've been reporting on it on the Bryant Park Project.
I know, clearly, we're all over the copper
clearly
story.
Clearly, it would be a big story there.
It is, actually. So, you know, we talked last week about the epidemic of copper theft, and that's because the price of copper is skyrocketing. So the story in the Arizona Republic is that the high price for copper and other metals is prompting some long-closed mines to be reopened. So things that have been closed for 30 years that may be... You know, the whole town shut down, everybody moved away, or the town had to remake itself in a new image, like an artistic community, something like that. You know, now the mining companies are sniffing around and saying, maybe we want to get back in here. And, you know, because copper costs now it's about $3.50 a pound. And it, just for context, about 4 years ago, it went for 70 cents a pound.
Wow.
So.
What I wondered about when I read that was, of course, Crandall Canyon, which is where the miners disappeared in Utah. Part of what was happening there was they were re-mining a mine that had already been sort of considered to be used up. And I'm just – I mean, I'd be curious to see if
Yeah, I'm not clear on whether these mines were tapped out or if they just were not economically feasible because the price was so low.
There
I mean,
was
that's
no
just something
demand,
we'd have to look
so.
Into. Yeah. The debate is, you know, right now environmental concerns and do we want to change the character of these towns?
Tricia McKinney, thank you so much. My most today is from the Wall Street Journal. It's the most, one of the most emailed. I think it's number four. The headline says, Canada is giddy about the loony and twitting U.S. Now, the loony is what they call the dollar in Canada because it's got a little loon on it. The loons, the loons. Well, anyway.
Easy, cat.
So, but here's the thing. It's talking about how weak the dollar is now and how Canadians think this is fantastic.
Right.
They just, they feel excited because their dollar is worth more. But the example they use might be the reason this is the most emailed. The owner of five strip clubs in Detroit says American dancers are heading to Canada to earn the strength in Canadian currency, and Canadian customers are heading to Detroit because their dollars go further there.
I think what was amazing about that story in the journal was that woodcut they had of a stripper on a pole. I mean, that was just a remarkable piece of artwork. When I lived in Seattle, you know, it's so close to Canada, and this was when the dollar was worth double the Canadian. The American dollar was worth double the Canadian dollar, and we used to always just say Canada half off. I mean, we loved that about Canada, but
no longer
the case.
No longer.
We've also got Matt Martinez, our very fine supervising senior producer. Excuse me. You unearthed a story from NPR.org.
Yeah, this is one of the most emailed at NPR.org, and it just plays into my hypochondria and just things of being dangerous for you. It's how to wash produce, and it was a story that Allison Aubrey, NPR reporter, did. It's one of the most emailed, and she talked to one of the editors of Cook's Illustrated, and they tried three different things. They tried just washing with water, washing with vinegar, and just like and soaking, and here's a little bit of that piece.
I've got a bottle filled with 3 cups of cold water and 1 cup of distilled white vinegar. And it's in a spray bottle, the kind you might mist your plants with.
Bishop sprays the apple with about 6 squirts of the solution, just enough to coat the surface, and then rinses it under the tap.
The cold water will obviously wash away any residual flavor from the vinegar and finishes the cleaning process.
So it's really less than a 30-second investment.
It's a 30-second, 50-cent investment because the vinegar is just so inexpensive. And if you put it in your pantry and you've got the bottle filled and ready to go, you don't need to do it every single time you go shopping.
And how soon did you do that, Matt, after hearing this report?
Immediately, I went out. And
you were already doing it with bleach, but then you decided to change over.
And actually, it kills 98% of bacteria on produce. And of course, that's only for fruit and stuff like that. You know, spinach and broccoli is harder to clean.
So you didn't shower this morning in vinegar, is what you're doing?
No.
It's like we're begging Saturday Night Live to do another parody skit about NPR when the most emailed story is about washing your produce. Next up, also how to organize your sock drawer.
The emotional life of wheat.
I would listen to that.
It's a good story. It's
Matt
good story.
Martinez, thank you so much. Okay, raise it and he will run, it being $30 million by November 30th. And then maybe former Republican House Speaker and political firebrand Newt Gingrich will run for president. First, he is establishing a new advocacy group. Get this name, American Solutions for Winning the Future.
Wow. I thought the future was a coin toss.
I have
but
no idea what they're
it.
Going to do. This is going to happen while his top advisor, Randy Evans, will spend October trying to lock up some campaign pledges. This while Rudy G takes a call from his wife during a speech, the Democrats get ready to rumble in New Hampshire, and Hillary Clinton was just about everywhere. For more on Newt's news and a little political preview is our friend Jim Vandehei, executive editor of Politico.com. Hey, Jim.
How are you doing?
Doing great. So what are the chances that Newt's people can come up with $30 million in 6 weeks?
Well, I've decided that if you guys can come up with $30 million to an NPR pledge drive, I'll run for president.
Vandehei,
not easy. I mean, who wouldn't run for president if we could get pledges of that kind of money? That will not be easy. I mean, Newt Gingrich has pretty good name recognition and still has a pretty good network of political supporters that he helped construct when he was Speaker of the House in the 1990s. But that's a lot of money, and a lot of that Republican money has already been vacuumed up by the other top-tier presidential campaigns. So I think it's unlikely that he'll be able to get commitments in that neighborhood. If he does, I think he'd be foolish not to get in because he wants to be part of the national dialogue. This guy is an ideas machine, and whether you love him or hate him, and there's a lot of people who have both feelings for him, he is one of the most provocative thinkers on the Republican side on the policy front right now.
Who would be looking over their shoulder with the most furrowed brow should he get into the race of all the Republican candidates?
I think all of the top tier would, because there still is a feeling out there among Republicans that they're not really that happy with the candidates that they have. You know, Fred Thompson was supposed to be the savior, and early indications are that he's had a fairly bumpy ride, and it's not clear that he's going to be the guy who can really capture their imaginations long term. I mean, if Newt got in, he has a pretty high name recognition, and he's a very forceful debater, so everyone would have to be worried that he'd pull conservatives away from them and into his camp, because he really would run as a pretty true conservative. His record is pretty consistent over the last decade. So unlike a Romney, who had to have some evolution and some flip-flopping on his past record to become a conservative, Newt has been consistently a conservative and consistently a critic of Hillary Clinton, which elevates his standing among Republicans who would like to see somebody who can defeat Hillary Clinton, who they think will get the nomination.
I want to run a couple other political headlines by you, things that happened over the weekend that were kind of interesting. Rudy Giuliani was speaking in front of the NRA when all of a sudden his cell phone rings and he takes this call from his wife. Can we play that?
Just think of the language of it. The language of it is the people shall be secure. But see now, this is my wife calling, I think. Hello, dear. I'm talking to the members of the NRA right now. Would you like to say hello? I love you, and I'll give you a call as soon as I'm finished, okay?
Spontaneous, wacky, kooky Rudy, staged, planned, just weird. What does your political gut tell you about this, Jim?
I'm going to go with pretty weird. I mean, it was already an awkward setting because the NRA folks are not big fans of Rudy Giuliani. They don't feel like he's been a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, particularly when he was mayor of New York. And then I said, it was very awkward to take a phone call when you're giving a speech, which would strike most people as kind of rude. And even if you didn't think it was rude, it seemed kind of contrived.
Yeah, and listening to the reaction.
I don't think that's what he was going for.
If the audio is any indication, they didn't sound like they were that into it. It was sort of like a titter.
Right, and they were already like, ah, yeah, whatever. He's talking about how he likes guns now. He didn't like them before. We don't believe him. And now he's doing this corny phone call with his wife. Hey, I don't think that helps him. You know, Rudy Giuliani is an amazing story of this campaign, though. The fact that he is still leading in the polls and has for some time, at least if you look at those national polls, is astounding. I mean, it defies all political logic, as logic is defined over the last 20 years of Republican primary politics, because he's at odds with them on whether it's guns or gay marriage or abortion. But he continues to win strong backing, even among evangelical Christians, which I think gets to one of the most fascinating points of this entire campaign. Politics has changed fairly radically. The issues that we used to think of and care about and debate in campaigns, whether you're going to raise taxes, you know, whether you're going to repeal Roe v. Wade, or in the last couple of elections, whether you're going to ban gay marriage, it's changed. We have a new set. Now you're talking about global warming, fighting terrorism, getting us out of Iraq, coming up with an energy policy that truly does make you less dependent on the Middle East because of rising oil prices. What you do with a housing market that is right now in trouble and probably going to be in a lot more trouble 6 months from now.
So, Jim, even as we were talking, they played a clip on CNN of Hillary Clinton in front of that bookcase, where she appeared on all five morning political shows yesterday morning, on Sunday morning, fielding questions mostly about the Iraq War and health care. What was your take when you heard that Hillary Clinton was going to be on all of the shows the same morning?
They're just so good at controlling her and controlling the message, and the fact that they can get all of the shows to agree to take her in one weekend, and it happens to be the weekend where she rolls out her health care plan, just shows like how much more sophisticated they are in manipulating us than the other campaigns. There's a lot of resemblances between the Clinton campaign and the Bush campaign in how good they are at controlling message and understanding which buttons to push inside of the sort of media structure to be able to maximize their exposure and do it in a controlled environment. I watched about three of the programs, and I thought, she's always pretty good. She's always very polished. She obviously understands policy as well, if not better than anybody else in this race. But the reaction I heard from some folks is the one I continue to hear when you talk to voters. Like, either you're like, wow, she's really impressive, or I just don't like her. There's something about her. I just don't like, you know, her loud laugh or the fact that she's a Clinton. And I think that's what she really has to overcome. She has to convince Democrats first that she is truly electable. And I still think that that is an open question. She's certainly electable in the Democratic primaries, but can she win in swing states?
And she seemed pretty entertained by at least Chris Wallace anyway.
What was up with that laugh? because of the delay and the timing, the laugh was even more amplified.
It was terrifying to watch.
It really was, and I thought that was an interesting way for Chris Wallace to open up the interview. The truth is, and when you're doing these interviews, especially with Hillary Clinton, you got to try to figure out some way to knock them off their game, and so you can get them to be a little bit candid. And it's virtually impossible with her. I mean, she's been on the national stage, and she's been poked and prodded so many times that she's so good at just saying what she wants to say, saying no more and saying no less,
and apparently really good at laughing in your face if she wants to,
and it's very loud, like. Laugh.
Jim VandeHei from Politico.com. Thanks for swinging by.
Have a good day.
Coming up, the doctor will email you now. A doctor who is going to do all of his seeing of patients over the internets. We're going to find out if that's such a great idea.
And Halo 3, the biggest video game launch ever, happens today. Did you see the setup down on 5th and 44th?
Yes.
It's kind of like it's the UN, only it's Halo 3 at Best Buy. Do you care about it? We'll try to make you. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. That Hillary Clinton laugh is going to haunt my nightscape, by the way. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, we're going to speak with a young doctor who has a new twist on how he wants to practice medicine. Says it's good for you, good for him. We'll find out all about it. Happens through the internets, by the way. But first, let's hear about today's top stories from our own newscaster, Ms. Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hi, Luke and Allison. Good morning, everyone. So it's been 7 days, and thousands of Buddhist monks in Myanmar are still marching in the streets demanding an end to the military regime in that country. It's the largest pro-democracy demonstration in Myanmar, also known as Burma, in about 20 years. Today, about 100,000 people protested outside the Defense Ministry building, calling for the release of Aung San Suu Kyi, the pro-democracy leader who has been under house arrest for the past 12 years. Myanmar's military government has sealed off the country to foreign journalists, but information about the protests has been flowing through wire reports and exiled democracy groups. The military regime crushed a national uprising in 1988, killing an estimated 3,000 civilians. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was asked about Burma as she arrived at the U.N. yesterday. She told reporters that the Bush administration is closely monitoring the protests. And the German government has given up trying to hold 13 CIA agents accountable for allegedly kidnapping a German citizen in the Balkans 4 years ago. Earlier this year, a German court ordered the arrest of the 13 operatives on suspicion of kidnapping Khaled El-Masri, a German citizen of Lebanese descent. El-Masri says the CIA agents abducted him while he was vacationing in Macedonia, then flew him to Afghanistan, where he was imprisoned for months and tortured. Last month, German officials asked the U.S. to extradite the CIA agents so they could be charged in the kidnapping. The U.S. said no. The case drew international attention to the CIA practice known as extraordinary rendition, when suspected terrorists are detained and flown to third-party countries to be interrogated. And remember that big MoveOn.org ad that the New York Times ran a couple weeks ago calling General David Petraeus, "David, betray us"? Well, there was a lot of uproar about the ad and the fact that the New York Times gave MoveOn.org a discount on it. Now the newspaper's own public editor says the Times broke its own rules in publishing the ad. The paper gave MoveOn a discount on the advertisement and ran it on the day Petraeus began his testimony before Congress on the war in Iraq. A spokeswoman for the New York Times has since apologized, and yesterday the paper's public editor, Clark Hoyt, wrote in his column that the ad, quote, violated the Times' own written standards. But Hoyt went on to say there was no evidence that the Times ran the ad for any partisan reasons. And finally today, some sports scores. In Sunday Night Football, the Cowboys outscored the Bears 31-7 in the second half to cruise to a 34-10 victory. And in baseball, the Los Angeles Angels clinched the AL West title and the Cleveland Indians took the AL Central crown. I'm Rachel Martin. The news and a little sports is always online at npr.org. Allison and Luke, back to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Don't call them the Los Angeles Angels. They're in Anaheim.
Oh, sorry.
They're officially called the Los Angeles Angels, but I, as a former Angeleno, disagree with that stridently.
It will never happen again.
Thank you. And it's Genghis Khan.
Thank you.
Okay.
Healthcare is more than a political issue for the candidates. It's a practical hurdle for so many people. I know stats can make your eyes glaze over, but I'm throwing this one out there anyway. The 2003 census data says 16 million people go underinsured in this country. One doctor in New York is offering what he sees as a real way to make a dent in the insurance issue. Dr. Jay Parkinson launches his New York practice today. And if you want to pay a visit, you don't go to a street, you go online to his website. And Dr. Parkinson joined us in the studio today. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
All right, so explain to me how this works. You're going to have your office essentially online. You're going to practice online?
No, not at all, actually. You go to my website and you can sign up for my service. And after you apply, I'm based in Williamsburg, so I will screen the applicants by age, as well as proximity to Williamsburg. And once they apply and they pay a deposit for the $500 annual fee, I will then visit them immediately in their home. I only do house calls.
So you actually are going to do old-fashioned medicine, where you're going to go to people's homes and take care of them that way.
That's correct.
So how does the online component fit in?
Well, if I've already established a relationship and done a physical exam, taken a whole medical history, and someone develops depression, for instance, I think there's a role for managing depression via video conferencing. After I've diagnosed it and put them on medication, we can have a weekly update via video conference. It's much easier for the patient. It's much easier for me.
So you do you kind of have your bedside manner through the internet.
Well,
sort of.
I mean, essentially. No, not really, because
okay. Well,
yeah,
no,
not
really. Well, you have to help me understand it then, because I guess I don't understand the premise.
Well, the online stuff will really supplement the actual visit.
Mm-hmm.
So you get two house call visits a year, which is about more than average for the demographic that I'm treating. How often they visit a healthcare provider per year. So I'll see them twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more per visit if they need more than two visits, and then I'll supplement their care with the online.
So I can email you if we've seen you. I've seen you. I've had a headache. Mm-hmm. It's about a week later. I'm not feeling so great. So I can email you and say, "Hey, doctor, this is what's going on."
Right.
And then what happens? I just get an email back, or
You can text me. You can IM me. You can email me. You can video chat me. Whatever. Yes. I'm not always online, but I'm always connected via my iPhone. So if you text me, I will pretty much immediately respond
to
you.
How did you get the idea for this? Because you said fresh out of your residency.
I am.
Was it just because you were talking to people and we all text each other so much and email so much that you thought, this is something I have to really integrate into my medical practice?
Well, sure. But really, the real problem that I noticed was that it's just healthcare is inaccessible for people who are uninsured or underinsured. And so many people in New York City especially are uninsured or underinsured, and they're young, healthy people who need care, and a lot of the times they develop acute issues that need immediate treatment, and there's nowhere for them to go. So they're also very wired, as am I.
Mm-hmm.
So I just figured it fit in pretty well with the demographic.
Do you think we were talking in our meeting about what we call web hypochondria, which I think we may I don't know if we coined that, but, it's this thing where it's 2 in the morning and you're having some ailment, or if you have kids, there are some strange things coming out of their nose, and you go online and try to find out through WebMD or something what the problem is. And I wonder about the reliability of those kinds of diagnoses. Do you think you're going to be able to – if somebody emails you, I have this weird rash on this weird part of my body, are you really going to be able to diagnose that, you think?
Well, no. I mean, the real issue is that I'm going to go visit them first and use the web to supplement their care.
Right.
So, but of course, sometimes you can. Sometimes somebody can, if they have acne, they can do a weekly photo of themselves, and we can follow up treatment that way, see how well the medication's working, and they can email me the photos. And I'll immediately upload it into my electronic medical record, and it's there in a 100% secure, HIPAA-compliant, web-based electronic medical record.
So I'm sure there's got to be somebody listening, and I thought this initially, I'll be honest, what about the malpractice issue in terms of giving advice over the internet online about something? Is that a concern for you? How are you addressing that just personally as a young doctor just starting out?
Sure. Well, there's been a long history of nurse triage lines, and they've published a lot of information on triage.
That would be a phone line you call into to get advice from a nurse.
Insurance companies offer this stuff.
Yeah.
So, I have a huge book of questions I need to ask for patients, and how soon they need to see emergency medical or medical care. Sometimes it'll be emergent, and I'll immediately go see them. Sometimes it can wait for tomorrow.
Is this going to cut down on your overhead, too, because you don't have to have an office with a secretary and old copies of National Geographic?
Of course. So much of this is automated. Somebody can go online and make an appointment. It'll immediately be texted to my iPhone. If I'm at someone's house, I'll go right where the text tells me to go.
You love that iPhone.
I know.
I do. My whole practice can be run on my iPhone, actually. It's really insane.
Now, what's your background medically? Where did you do your residency and in what?
Well, I went to Penn State for medical school. I did a pediatrics residency at St. Vincent's Hospital here in the West Village. And I did a preventive medicine residency at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore.
So you feel confident that a 38-year-old person who calls up, and I've just broken my arm snowboarding, that you're going to be able to give him the proper advice and the proper care and the proper direction?
Yeah, of course. No problem at all. See, I don't see... The disease profile of, a demographic kind of changes after age 40. Mm. Sorry about that implication. But anyway, from pediatricians really see patients up to age 21. But 21 to 40, the diseases that people suffer from are really similar to, you know, older children, adolescents, you know, 21-year-olds. So
and
I don't have a problem.
That's who you're focused into. That's when you've been talking about your demographic. That's who you're really thinking you're going to be treating the most.
18 to 40 year olds. I won't accept anybody over 40.
What are some of those disease profiles? Is it arm broken, snowboarding?
Sure. Injuries, colds and flu, depression, STIs.
What's an STI?
Sexually transmitted infection.
Right. It sounds like what you're
that
really
does
doing
sound like something you want to actually email to your doctor rather than face him or her.
This sounds like the ultimate sort of old school, new school combination, because you're like the old country doctor who would actually come out, call Doc Parkinson, but it's more like text Doc Parkinson.
Exactly. And that's the concept. I mean, I don't know how successful this could be in a place, you know, in a rural place, because, you know, I'm dependent upon my patients being in a very, you know, concentrated neighborhood in Brooklyn and Manhattan.
Well, Dr. Jay Parkinson, it's a big day for you. Thanks for making time to be with us and explain how it's all going to go down. We'll check back in with you in a couple months.
And let's mention the website, too. It's jayparkinsonmd.com. jayparkinsonmd.com. You know, I just moved to New York. I don't have a doctor. I live in Park Slope.
There you go.
I snowboard.
Could
text be a match.
Me.
I'll text you, Dr. Parkinson. Well, speaking of medical problems, I was nearly killed last night, Allison.
Oh, no. What happened?
Well, I was standing in line at the Rite Aid in Park Slope, and there was this huge pyramid of Mountain Dew Game Fuel sodas. Yes, they actually make a soda for video gamers. And they had stacked this mountain of Mountain Dew kind of incorrectly, and it tumbled near me and around me, and my entire life flashed before my eyes. But the other thing that flashed before my eyes was the image on every box of this video game character named Master Chief. He's the star of Halo 3, which was being promoted heavily by Game Fuel. And here in Manhattan, it's like everywhere. There were commercials running all day yesterday during the football games.
There are Klieg lights on the street corner across from us where they're getting ready for the debut of Halo 3.
Jeez, this is like a total phenomenon. Yeah, they've already pre-sold more than 1 million copies. And Microsoft, who makes the game, they're hoping that this will be popular enough to actually spur on more sales of the Xbox 360 system. Clearly, this is a really big deal. Clearly, I do not care. So clearly, this is a perfect Make Me Care segment. And here to help us is Dan Ackerman, a senior editor at CNET. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great. I understand you've actually played this game.
I've not only played it, I just beat it yesterday.
What?
I know, and that's one of the cool things about it is you can go online and hook up with three of your friends, and you can all play through together. Now, I'm not normally the kind of guy who would do this. I'm a very casual gamer at best, but getting four people together, getting some of your friends and going through it, that's a lot of fun.
Wait a second.
A party.
Yeah, you beat it. Wait, you already beat it. When I was a kid,
I know,
back in the 90s, Super Mario Brothers, it would take you like weeks to beat a game. How long did it take you to beat this thing?
You know, this took probably 6 or 7 hours, cut up over maybe 2 days, and that's one of the complaints people have had about the game so far, is that the single-player part of it is kind of short, but most people play for the multiplayer, which is when you go online and fight other people.
Okay, why do you think this game is so popular?
Why do I think it's so popular? It's popular because everyone loves that kind of sci-fi melodrama. It's popular because it's kind of easy to pick up and play. It's not one of those games that's so complicated you need to read the instruction book for an hour before you play. And it's like a big, dumb summer blockbuster movie.
Okay. I'm still, I would say, teetering on the edge of caring or not caring. Let's see if you can sort of tip me over, Dan Ackerman. We're going to put 60 seconds on the official BPP clock.
Okay.
When you hear the ticking clock, you have 10 seconds to wrap up. Microsoft launches Halo 3 at midnight tonight. Dan Ackerman, make me care.
Well, you should care about Halo 3 less as a video game and more as a cultural touchstone. It's an indicator of where we are as an entertainment-consuming culture. I'll be the first to tell you, this is not high art. It's about a guy in a spacesuit shooting aliens, and then a whole lot of things, you know, blow up. It's Star Wars. It's Die Hard. And we've heard a lot of hype about different games over the years, but this is the first time there's a game that's really on the same level as a big summer blockbuster movie. It's got the TV ad campaign. It's got the requisite junk food tie-in, T-shirts, toys. You've got the million pre-orders. That's the equivalent of a movie selling $60 million in tickets before it even opens. So what we should care about is how Halo 3, probably more than any game before it, offers a kind of social utility to a big swath of people 35 and under. In the same way as internet viral videos and South Park quotes and MySpace, it gives us a common frame of reference in an isolated, cubicle-filled world. And that's why Halo is important.
How much game fuel did you have before this interview, Dan?
Absolutely zero. I would never go near that now.
Well, you know what?
Wait, touchstone, social
utility.
Utility. If you throw it in the word paradigm, you would almost have it.
Wow, Dan Ackerman, that was an amazing, amazing amount of energy for you to be generating at this hour of the morning. You did a great job. I still do not care, but I think you hopefully made someone else out there care.
I kind of care about the commerce of it. You got me on that part of it.
It's huge. It's a huge business. With the holiday shopping season coming up, everybody needs a huge hit, and this is the one everyone's hanging their hat on because Grand Theft Auto 4, the other big game, has been delayed until next year.
Okay. That will be a make me care for future reference. Dan Ackerman, senior editor at CNET. I bet this is one of those things where I don't know if you're married or you have a girlfriend.
I'm married to a female game journalist.
I was going to say, because you probably said, guess what I did? I beat Halo 3. And she said, make me care, probably. Maybe not.
She had a little headset on. I was blasting around.
Oh, that's cute.
See, they're in Lerv.
Sweet. That's
cute. All right, Dan, thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
That is it for the Bryant Park Project for today. Thank you so much for listening in.
Our staff includes MJ Davis, Ilya Meritz, Dan Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld, Carrie Toby. We are very happy to welcome our web producer, Laura Conaway. Good to be here, Laura. Good to have you here.
Our newscaster is Rachel Martin.
Our senior producer, Matt Martinez. Our editor, Tricia McKinney, you guys were all in on Sunday working so hard. We appreciate that.
Our executive producer is Ms. Sharon Hoffman.
I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Allison Stewart. Come visit us at our blog, because we'd like you to. It's npr.org/Bryant Park. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.